All right, hello everyone. Welcome back to Oncology Decoded, where cancer science meets clarity. With me is Ben Garmazy, and we are not recording on a Friday today, something very different for us. Ben, how are you today?
Doing okay. Excited to talk about urothelial cancer. It's what I wake up to talk about. So let's go.
All right, so we have a special topic in mind today. We were thinking about talking about second line therapy in bladder cancer. So beyond EVP, what do we think about and how do we think about it? But before we get there, Ben, ever since the EV pembrolizumab data came out, it kind of shifted the whole landscape, right? So we are only using EVP. But there are a subgroup of patients where you would not use EVP. So before we delve into what do you do at time of progression on EVP or first line therapy, very quickly, how are you thinking which patients should get EV plus pembrolizumab, or are you using gemcitabine in some patients? How are you thinking your first line therapy now that we have more longer term data?
Yeah, I think this is a good point. And we did see new data presented at ASCO in only a few weeks ago in June of this year. So let's talk about the standard of care is enfortumab vedotin. That's a Nectin-4 antibody drug conjugate with an MMAE payload. So let's set the stage for those of us that don't treat a lot of urothelial cancer. And we combine that with pembrolizumab. And that is, as I view it, the frontline standard of care, at least in the United States where it's available, right? And soon, hopefully, everywhere globally. We've seen really nice response rates. And what was presented this year at ASCO was more information on the durability. They looked at cisplatin eligible patients and cisplatin ineligible patients because we know that some of those have a better prognosis than others. And they showed that there was roughly about the same, almost, if you had a response, a 2-year durability of response, if you had a response. Now, most people do get a response, but only about 2/3 to 70% of patients get a response. And then if you had a complete response, that complete response was still there 2 years later in 75% of patients. So a really remarkable showing that if you do well in those first 3 to 6 months on enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab, you're primed to do well for a really, really long time, which I think adds more data in support of this combination. But you did mention some other combinations. So at the same ESMO conference a while back, when EVP was first presented, we had CheckMate 901 also presented, which was cisplatin, gemcitabine, nivolumab, which did have a statistically significant improvement over the standard of care, which was chemotherapy. Just the chemo doublets alone, whether you had that in that trial, it was cisplatin and gemcitabine, but the current paradigm, or I should say the prior paradigm, was either a gemcitabine with a platinum doublet, and then in the US with avelumab maintenance, right? That javelin paradigm where you gave them 4 to 6 cycles of chemo, and if they had SD, CR, or PR, then you continued on just the immunotherapy alone. So we saw data there. Now, in my opinion, that EV pembro data kind of blew everything else out of the water, and that should be the standard for the vast, vast majority of patients. I think what you're alluding to is there are some patients that can't get EVP, and we need to figure out who those patients are. There's criteria called the AVITA criteria that was developed by a group in Spain that is interesting, but I personally think doesn't really capture who that patient is that shouldn't get EVP. Because basically it's just predicting for patients who aren't going to do as well on any therapy, right? So when I think about who shouldn't get EVP or what are the unique toxicities of EV or what we need to discuss, everyone will get neuropathy at some point. I know in the trials it's not 100%, but it feels like it's 100% in the real world when if they're on it long enough. You have skin toxicity that's unique, right? And then you also have the hyperglycemia problem, right? Those are the big three that I think stand out relative to the chemotherapy paradigm. Am I missing anything there?
No, I don't think you are. I think that is very much the same same as how I would think about it. Now, the only question is, extent of disease, right? So when you're talking about EVP first line therapy, and again, just to give a very high level, very quick here, generally you're thinking about widely metastatic disease. Are you thinking about those lymph node only patients differently? No, I have had some experience, anecdotal now, obviously this is not a randomized trial, but anecdotally, when we have these patients that have locally advanced urothelial carcinoma, where generally their lymph nodes are a little bit more higher up or lateral, right? They don't fit into your textbook like you're going to give them neoadjuvant chemotherapy and then you're going to try to go to surgery but with the hope that you can convert them. So those are not necessarily patients that I would use EVP for, right? I could use gemcitabine. We've seen a very high response rates in gemcitabine for that group of patients and then try to get them to surgery afterwards, even though they're technically considered M1 disease because of the extent or the lymph nodes that we're looking at. But Outside of that, I agree with everything you're saying. I don't know how you're approaching these patients. I don't know if you're doing something differently, but curious, what are you doing?
This is the beautiful phrase called shared decision making, right? So I think what you're alluding to is the data set of the lymph node only patients where they had an 82% response rate on cisgem/nivo. Now, those patients were primed to do well. We know cisplatin does really well in a subset of patients. Sounds like these are the subset of patients. And you're right. They looked at lymph nodes above in the chest, as well as kind of more close in the pelvis that we would think of traditionally more as a stage three disease. Didn't matter where the lymph nodes were, the response rates were about the same. So anyone with lymph node only disease did really well on that triplet. But we also have to remember, they also did really well on the EV pembro data as well, about 79% response rate there. So that's a total wash, that's equivalent. So what I did the last time I had a patient in my office, it was about 8 weeks ago, we discussed, would you rather go through four cycles of chemoimmunotherapy, which would be more aggressive and probably feel more toxic up front, so that you had the chance of being on an immunotherapy maintenance for longer? Or would you rather get kind of what I call, quote unquote, the standard, but would include a cytotoxic agent for longer, that EV pembro paradigm? They did select, that patient did select the EV pembro. So I am doing shared decision making. I do think I'm going to lean mostly on EV pembro in this population, though I do think cisgem/nivo is totally reasonable and wouldn't fault anyone for wanting to give it because of those reasons.
That's a fair analysis. I can't argue with that. I can't even find any significant faults with it, right? I mean, we're going to see the perioperative data coming out soon, and it may change this whole landscape. It will change this whole landscape, I imagine, in which case we may not need to be in this specific paradigm. But kind of getting to our topic at hand for today, which is what do you do beyond EV pembrolizumab or beyond gemcitabine and cisplatin, and or even for those patients that are on maintenance therapy because they were high risk and are on immunotherapy. How do you think about those patients, right? So, we've seen molecular
Oh,
testing,
no, we got to
obviously.
stop you. Before
Sure.
we do that, which patient would you not give EV pembro to? Is there a specific patient from a side effect profile that you wouldn't give it to?
No, I think the patient population where I would not give it to is actually rather slim. The only patient that I wouldn't give it to is those that I cannot give immunotherapy to. But or if they have really bad hyperglycemia that I'm really worried about from EV standpoint or so, but it's really hard to find that, like, who can I not give this to outside of the immunotherapy classic contraindications, right? If somebody's got really bad IBD, like inflammatory bowel syndrome, then and they're on a biologic, I may not be comfortable giving them EVP, or but they would also not be getting immunotherapy in general. So I wouldn't even give them like the I wouldn't even give them pembrolizumab or nivolumab for high risk disease, right? These are patients that I would give them probably just chemo, and then I wouldn't even give them maintenance avelumab, right? I wouldn't be giving them anything from an immunotherapy standpoint. So I think that's probably my only contraindication that I can really think of, because I think most everything else you can maneuver your way through, right? You can, even if it's hyperglycemia, you can adjust the sugars, you can watch them a little bit closer, you can titrate the medications, you can do all those things and get them through the drug.
I
So I
think
really
that's
don't
the
know that.
that's the biggest point of conversation. Sorry to cut you off, but that is something that comes up all the time with our academic colleagues. And I think of there's two kind of patients, the mild psoriasis to moderate psoriasis patient that you might give a checkpoint inhibitor therapy to, but maybe you don't want to give it in combination with EV because of the skin tox. And in those patients, maybe if you think you could get cisgem/nivo into them, I might consider that. That cisgem's actually going to tamp down some of that psoriatic risk, I think, right? From the immune suppression from the chemotherapy. So I think, and then you get them on a maintenance. So I think that's one patient population. The other patient population that comes up a lot from that we hear might be contraindicated, though I disagree, and I think you probably are with me, is those patients that are on that are diabetic. If they have insulin, it's easy. You just titrate the drugs, right? If they're pre-diabetic, obese patients that clearly are going to tip into insulin resistance and need true insulin therapy by giving them EV, because we know that, well, in the trial, 5% had grade 3 hyperglycemia, though it seems to be higher potentially in the real world, perhaps because the patients we're selecting. But those patients, I'm just warning them that they might need insulin in the future, and all of them are okay with that. So I'm not, as long as we're checking it. Now we do have to get used to prescribing oral hypoglycemics and perhaps prescribing Lantus and things like that. as investigators out there in the community. But I do think that I'm not withholding that drug for that population either. So it is, I agree, a very narrow population. So now we can loop back to the question that we were asking about subsequent therapy, right?
So a quick comment on that, and then we'll
Yeah.
get back to what you're saying. So, with the diabetes thing, there are a lot of drugs in community oncology that require glucose monitoring, right? You look at breast cancer, AKT inhibitors, mTOR inhibitors, right? So they all require hyperglycemia, or they all have hyperglycemia as a side effect. So I think our colleagues in the community are actually very savvy to manage diabetes because of these cross-disciplinary medications that we are actually using. But I agree with you. I don't think that would be a preclusion for me at all. I mean, when EV first came out, that was, but at this point, I don't think that is anymore. So anyway, so as you were saying, so for second line, so what's beyond EV pembrolizumab, or what's beyond gemcitabine? What are you going to do? When are you doing the molecular testing? And then are you looking for your FGFR? Are you going to platinum-based chemotherapy, right? So generally speaking, taxanes, right? Taxane-based monotherapy in bladder cancer are dismal. They are terrible drugs, and I don't. And the response rates are awful. And so we've seen ADCs. Sacituzumab obviously got its label pulled, but TROPiCS was the breast cancer study, and then you saw the sacituzumab data in TROPHY-U01 study, right? So they had many different cohorts that looked at bladder cancer in the advanced setting. And initially, it showed a great response rate for when you compare it to the late line patient who's been on single agent chemotherapy. It still showed over a 20% response rate, which is, when you think about chemotherapy, it's like double the response rate, right? But unfortunately, because of side effects, it got pulled. But then we have the FGFR inhibitors. Now we're seeing newer FGFR inhibitors that are coming into play. And then we have our platinum doublet. Where are you going with this? Where How are you thinking about it, and what are you thinking? And are you using SASE, even though it's technically off? It's not off label in the sense that it's still on NCCN, but it's off label in the sense that the FDA, the withdrawal was there, right, from the label.
Yeah, I think that this is a lot of loaded questions because the answer is yes, sometimes the SG, and I don't really know what to do, right? So unfortunately, after EV and Pembro, we have burned almost all of our good cards in urothelial carcinoma. Not all, but almost. And you're right. When EV Pembro got approved, Andrea Palo gave a great discussion about what's the next standard of care in second line therapy. And she mentioned that that's where the platinum doublets now come in, Cisgem or Carbogem, right? Because they used to be frontline. Well, now we're using something else. So those moved to the second line. That's a natural, obvious distinction. The problem is most patients, given the neuropathy risk that I mentioned on EV, right, are not going to be Cisgem candidates anymore. So if you're not a Cisgem candidate, you're going to give Carbogem in this patient population. I've done it, but I don't like doing it. The response rates, even in frontline with Carbogem, aren't that great. By the time you move them to second line, I imagine if we ran that study, they would be about 25, 30%, right? Nothing super high, but very, very toxic, especially now to a patient that's been on therapy for a while, right? So you don't lose the toxicity, but you lose some of the efficacy. So I don't love that. And then when you do give it, then we don't know that that maintenance immunotherapy approach is going to work in that patient population. So it's a very short-lived response, even if you get it. So if you need to kind of salvage somebody, sure. But I have a lot of issues. I do give it, but I don't like giving it. And sometimes it feels like it's not the right choice for the patient. So I don't give it all the time as my second line choice, but that's there. It's not one I
So
use a
Ben,
lot.
let me ask you, do you
Yeah.
ever use Docetaxel and MVAC in your second line setting? If you're not liking the gem cis, or if you're not liking gem carbo, and you just said platinum, cisplatin is tough for these patients just based on how they were, right? Is there a situation where you would ever think of using Docetaxel and MVAC?
Yeah, maybe somebody's been off EV for 18 months and doing well, and they had some minor thing pop up and they wanted another induction round and then get to get back on immunotherapy, maybe. But I have trouble buying that there's a patient I would do that for given the toxicities. But maybe you've tried it. Have you tried that?
I have not. I have not. I've not tried gem. I've not tried docetaxel MVAC. Gem cis, yes. I mean, as good as EVP is, it works. I mean, you're still talking about 30% of patients to 35% of patients that don't respond,
Right,
right?
right.
And so there are those patients that have either hyper progression, or they progress incredibly quick when they're on EVP. And so for those patients, I've generally gone through GemCis. And, at that point, do you try a maintenance again after the initial induction, right? So I'm not thinking GemCis Nivo, I'm really saying GemCis as just platinum doublet, and then you go, depending on the response, as monotherapy with kind of avelumab, right? You're following like a Javelin protocol, not necessarily with the hope that you're going to change your survival, but more of just maintaining. That's kind of what I've done. I don't know if you've done something similar or what.
Honestly, I haven't had a patient that had a hyper progression like that, but I do think if I and they do they are out there if you look at the data. I do think if I had somebody who was progressing after 3 to 4 cycles of EV pembro on that first scan, I absolutely would do exactly what you're doing. And then I would give them the benefit of doubt to try further immune therapy maintenance in that patient population, right? Because maybe they didn't get enough time to have a checkpoint inhibitor response. So I 100% agree in those patients that I would try it. Whether or not it would work, we have no idea, right? And some of those patients are probably just prone to be immune refractory but we would want to give them the benefit of the doubt.
So, in your experience, Ben, what do you think the actual response rate to platinum doublet and second line bladder cancer actually is?
With Carbogem, which is where I have more experience, I gotta think it's probably about 25-30%, as I mentioned. It certainly doesn't feel higher than that. I've given it to a
Yeah.
decent number of people, and honestly, I'm seeing on that first scan primary progression on the vast majority of them.
How do you approach those patients that have an FGFR alteration, right? The ones that are
I mean,
specifically
that's the
indicated
thing.
for that indicated for erdafitinib, and then you have somebody that has higher volume disease. So I'm going to give you a scenario, and this is actually a scenario that's actually in my clinic. I'm curious to get your thoughts, right? So if you have somebody that progressed hyperprogression on EV pembrolizumab, young patient, and has liver mets now, and you know that the target is also there for FGFR3. Now, if you think about GemCis versus erdafitinib, and this patient is mildly symptomatic in the sense that she's telling you that there's some discomfort, and you know that there is abdominal discomfort, to be more specific. And so how would you choose your drug?
See, I think you made the question harder by saying hyper progressing. So I'm thinking like progressing within 3 months, I'm going to give GemCis because the FGFR inhibitors were developed after the chemo. But if it was just progressing, okay,
Progress.
just
Okay.
progressing, if we take out the word hyper, which I think is the more natural situation here in our clinics, right? But just progressing on EV pembro, maybe they've been on for 6 months, maybe they've been on for 18 months, maybe they've been on for 2.5 years, right? But in those patients, if they're FGFR positive, response rates on erdafitinib are 40%, right? And we know that that's a 40% kind of post chemo for the most part. I'm going to give erdafitinib. Now, erdafitinib is not the easiest drug. It's clunky. It's got a lot of side effects that are unique, right? And you got to check labs and raise the dose potentially based on phosphorus values. So it's not the easiest drug to give, but it is at least a biomarker selective drug with a 40% response rate. And whether or not how it would fare with head to head in chemo in the post EV pembro space, we really don't know, right? But I imagine that it probably wouldn't look a lot worse. So I would go with erdafitinib. And if I had a HER2 option, which you didn't mention in that, now we do have a pan solid tumor approval for HER2 ADCs in this space. Overall response rates in the 3+, that's where the approval is, 52%. Now, granted, less than 20 patients in, with urothelial cancer. So who knows if that 52% would hold up. But still, I would give that drug if that was an option, right? Now, in the 2+, technically, there's not an FDA label there. The response rates were 36%. Not sure if I would give that or try to get insurance approval for that over traditional chemotherapy right away. It might be something worth petitioning the insurers down the line when you have no other options, right? But I think if you're 3+, I would give the HER2 drug. If you're FGFR positive, I would give that drug. If you're both, I don't know, I'd probably go with the level one evidence with the FGFR inhibitor, but I'm not 100% sure. Because that was a pure urothelial trial. And it hasn't really come up where I've had a 3+ and FGFR at the same time. I've had the 2+ FGFRs, but never, not personally yet, have to make that decision. But I do think I probably would lean on erdafitinib first. So I'd probably rank in my choices erda, HER2, and then doublet chemotherapy in that space. But maybe you have a different opinion. Maybe you have the same opinion.
Actually, it's very similar, right? So I actually do EVP first, then it's really checking for the molecular markers. And if I can give them chemo, then it would usually be gemcitabine. If not, and they do have an FGFR alteration, then it's really symptomatic, asymptomatic, extended disease, and what and you know, FGFR, if you use a drug a lot, that can be a scary drug to start sometimes. It takes a lot of coaching and education from a toxicity standpoint, right? The fingernails, the phosphate levels, it you have to watch these patients very closely. Versus chemo is much easier in that sense. I also have not had any patients where they've had HER2 3 plus and FGFR. I actually think
They
they're
do exist. I haven't either, but they do exist.
yes, you're right. I don't know the percentage of what the similarity is between the two of them, but HER2 is also a dynamic marker, right? So HER2 is one of those things where we have to check more often versus FGFR. Generally, it's either there or not. It's not going to be one of those things that you're going to see a clonal evolution for. At least that has not been the experience from the history of FGFR so far. So we'll have to see where that goes. But HER2 is definitely worthwhile, right? Because if you check in on the original TURBT specimen and then they had developed metastatic disease, the HER2 expression actually may be different in the metastatic site as opposed to the original TURBT. So, are you agreeing with me? Are you disagreeing with me? What do you think?
I think that all makes sense. And the only thing that I will quibble with is you saying that perhaps chemo is less toxic than erdafitinib. I wouldn't go that far with a doublet chemotherapy. I would not go that far. But I do think, one of the challenges with that drug is the toxicity. I think you saw data from ASCO on FORAGER-1, which is a new FGFR inhibitor being created by Loxo. We'll see if it gets across the finish line, at least from the data that's publicly available that's been presented. The tox rates are lower because of the selectivity of that molecule. So I think we're not done in this space yet, is my point. There are other FGFR inhibitors being developed as well. There's one from Tyra Pharmaceuticals. There's other ones out there. So hopefully one of these can come across. So at least we have some options in the marketplace. But we do like erdafitinib right now for patients because it's biomarker selected. And then once we move past all these targets, right, then we're left with single agent taxane, as you mentioned, docetaxel, paclitaxel, whichever you want, which historically have had response rates of about, 15-ish, 17-ish%. And you had sacituzumab govitecan, which you were mentioning on the TROPHY study, had response rates that were higher, which were about 27 to 30%. But then in TROPICS-04, the confirmatory study mandated by the regulators that went head to head against single agent chemo, it did not meet statistical significance. Actually, response rates decreased for SG to, I think, about 24% and increased a little bit for the chemotherapy arm to just a little bit above 20%. But we did see more neutropenic deaths on SG. This was a global study. Growth factor use wasn't being given. And a lot of us in the US are providing growth factor support for sacituzumab govitecan. So when you ask, do I still use this drug? I've been waiting to say, yes, I do. And now, if they don't have one of those biomarkers we just discussed, right? And my option is SG. Or, single agent chemotherapy, I am going to reach for SG every single time in my
Let me
patient
ask you a
population.
clarifying. Let me ask you a clarifying question. So, if you're using SG, are you thinking that you're using SG after the use of at least platinum doublet? You're not going ADC switch to ADC switch, right? So, I just want to understand. So,
I
you're not
might.
using. Okay, so that's interesting. So, you're not using. Are you using EVP? Then you may go to SASE, or are you thinking EVP, gem carbo, and then SASE? That's why I'm asking that question.
No,
Like, are
you
you
just
going?
asked me if I would give a HER2 ADC after EV Pembro, right? So I'm going to be
No, I'm
completely
asking you about
blunt. But
SASE,
now we're going to
though.
SG. Look, if they were a cis candidate, I would give cisgem. Okay.
Okay.
Now, if there's somebody who is not a cis candidate and we're deciding there's no biomarker and it's carbo gem or sassy, it's probably going to be more like half and half in my patient population, which is maybe not what you were expecting. And the reasons for that is, after some of my anecdotal experiences bias me, I just don't think carbo-gem works well enough to justify the toxicity. And once we've failed EVP, we are purely talking a palliative approach here, right? We're not going to have probably a long-term durable response, but we can get disease control. And if you do look at the data sets on both data sets with SG, some patients actually do really, really well. So I personally think SG is less toxic if we give it appropriately. And there's a lot of patients that I don't think can tolerate carbogem, but can tolerate SG. And from my own personal experience, I don't find one to be that much more efficacious than the other after EVP. So, yes, I have no problem sequencing ADCs. We've seen that they're safe to combine. We've seen that they're safe to sequence. We don't have relative efficacy data, right? So we are kind of being blinded by our own anecdotes here. But I am using SG in about half of my patients that are carbogem eligible, but not in my cisgem eligible patients. But I know it's lost its
That's
FDA approval, right? So
yeah,
we need to be
but
very clear about that.
correct. And I guess we'll see more yet to come. I mean, the reason I think was the toxicity, probably more so than anything else. The toxicity seemed to be higher than I would have expected. You know, we were participating in that study and definitely didn't see that that was the case. But when you
Are
look at
you
the data
giving growth
overall,
factor support, Manoj, for all your patients?
we were not until there
Okay.
was a In the initial trial, there was no recommendation for growth factor support for using SG in the advanced urothelial cancer patients, right? So that was that came as an amendment later on.
Right. And
So,
that's what I'm now doing. You know, I've been doing it
yeah.
for a long time now. Everyone gets growth factor support on day 9 on that combination. You know, you give the drug day 1, day 8 of a 3-week cycle. So all my patients are getting that. Some of my patients are starting at 7.5 because of those toxicity concerns, but I'm still starting some of them at 10 based on how robust they are. But all of them get G-CSF.
Now, yeah, I completely agree. Now they
Yeah.
all do. Previously, when the first study came out, the TROPION-Lung01 for U1 for the cohort one study, we were not doing that. I think we were only doing it depending on how the count recovery or how the blood counts were actually affected. And we were not getting recovery because these are very heavily pretreated patients. That was when we were using growth factor support for studies. So that's where we are, I think, with second line bladder cancer. Now, I'm going to ask you an intriguing question that I've been thinking about, and one of them was actually one of the studies that we were talking about at our previous episode when we were looking at some of the exciting data that came out of ASCO, right? We're looking about the JAVELIN Medley trial. Right? We've seen some interesting data with maintenance therapy using SG and immunotherapy combination after induction. Now, when we have some patients that are the hyper progressions, right? Or even very quick progression, not even necessarily hyper progression, but those that are progressing on systemic therapy within 6 months or within a year, let's say. Is that something that you would think about doing?
So what you're alluding to is by adding sacituzumab govitecan to the avelumab in this phase two study that looked at multiple arms, multiple combinations to build upon that maintenance paradigm. Sacituzumab govitecan actually dramatically increased progression-free survival. We don't know anything about overall survival. And to me, it's increasing progression-free survival by about what we would expect based off where it does as a monotherapy, right? It's kind of, to me, almost, I don't know if it's synergistic. It seems to be additive and that is what we have seen with SGIO combinations, in my opinion, in a frontline setting. Now, that being said, would it be reasonable to consider if you were really concerned about progression? I think, sure, there's now good safety data. SG has been combined with immunotherapy in the neoadjuvant space. It's now been combined in that switch maintenance frontline space, and it's been combined in true frontline metastatic space as well. So I think it'd be reasonable. Do I think I would do it very often? The answer is probably not, because after chemo, I'm probably thinking again, they've progressed on EV Pembro. This patient's probably not one of those 5-year out survival urothelial patients. You're going to give them chemo. You want to give them a little bit of break so that they can enjoy some time on the immunotherapy, and then you have SG later. That's how I would approach the vast majority of my patients. Is there a patient where maybe I would try to petition a payer to get it? I'm sure there's some kind of young guy or a young woman who's trying to meet some milestones, right, where we're going to try to push everything we can to get there. Maybe in that situation, I would give it. I do think that data is important because it tells us that SG still has activity, right? Which we knew, those of us who give it knew that. But I do think it cements that TROP2 is a good validated target in urothelial carcinoma as more TROP2 agents are going to be moving into this space. But it also tells us that SG still has activity if used properly. So I wouldn't use it for most patients, maybe one or two out there, but what about you? Have you used it?
No, I have not used SG with immunotherapy as a maintenance combination. Actually, I have not used that combination at all. as of right now. I haven't found the right patient where I would use that. But I agree with you. I think there are some subgroup of patients where this would be a good option from a maintenance therapy standpoint, especially if they are progressing pretty quickly, then I would give them chemotherapy, and I would consider using immunotherapy with sacituzumab. We have safety data, as you said. We know the response data is there. This would be a good option, and perhaps this is a situation to look at for bladder cancer as another therapy comes about, right? Because if we keep moving EVP up earlier and earlier, then we're certainly going to still find patients that are going to progress on that therapy, right? Unfortunately, that'll be the case. And so, depending on when you progress off of EVP, and whether it's technically a second line patient or a true first line patient, I mean, it depends on timing, right? So, in the sense that, are they progressing right after on the maintenance situation, or are they progressing after a certain amount of time after they complete it? So it really depends on when we're using EVP, and I think that becomes more unclear as to what to do in those scenarios. But I think one thing that we have to harp that I think is really important is the testing, right? So I'm certainly checking for molecular testing with either tissue or liquid, and then HER2, because it opens us up for another option of therapy that we wouldn't have had otherwise. And we'll see where the ADCs evolve. And as you said, there's newer molecules that are coming out from the ADC standpoint that will keep changing this paradigm.
Yeah, I think that's important. I think liquid is pretty good for FGFR, but we still need tissue in this disease. It can't just be a liquid biopsy. That'll also help with getting FGFR, but it'll also, HER2, other of these targets. So I think now we need to be doing liquid and tissue in urothelial cancer. Previously, I might have just said maybe one tissue sample is enough, but I do think there's some dynamics going on here that require that we at least consider at some point kind of considering both. So I'm glad you mentioned that. That's critical, as we need to make sure that every urothelial cancer patient is tested for these targets, because historically there were less biomarkers involved in urothelial cancer. Now we have two really strong ones, and it's only going to move forward and to have more and more biomarkers in this disease as some of these new drugs come out.
So let me ask you some practical questions here, right? So you've always had these differences between upper tract bladder cancer versus lower tract bladder cancer. Do you, in your mind, think about them differently when you think about second line bladder cancer patients?
I think about them differently, but I don't treat them differently in the second line or in the metastatic setting. The only time where I clinically treat them differently is perhaps in the adjuvant setting. So that might change in the very near future, as you were predicting earlier, that perhaps ADC immunotherapy combinations are going to become the new standard of care in perioperative urothelial cancer, probably in the next 2 years at some point, given data that we've seen in earlier phase studies. But for now, I am not using that in metastatic disease as a treatment selection. The only reason I mention adjuvant is the POUT trial with chemotherapy doublets has a nice, survival advantage. What we saw with adjuvant nivolumab, perhaps the forest plot in upper tract disease, looking on the wrong side of one in that graph, perhaps not showing as much benefit as the lower tract patients. Now, Niagara, if you started on, Cisgem Durva, would be probably a totally reasonable regimen. But for those patients that didn't get neoadjuvant care, I'm kind of leaning sometimes towards the POUT trial and upper tract disease. Do you use it at all in metastatic disease as a demarcation?
I don't. I don't think it clinically makes any difference. I think the only thing that it helps me figure out is FGFR, right? FGFR, we see a slightly higher incidence for the upper tract as well as the more lower tract, compared to the lower tract. But I think it just a reminder saying, well, if we're thinking upper tract, we really need to test for FGFR versus lower tract, we may not see it as often. That's really the only thing that would sway me. Outside of that, nothing else. I want to ask you some clinical pearl questions, right? Because second line bladder cancer, I think, is a little bit challenging. And why I say that is because we have a lot of nuances that we can go, right? You can be in HER2 from a HER2 targeted because that's a panel mutation. It can be the chemo, as we were talking about. It can be the FGFR inhibitors. If you have a patient that's on on or defect. How are you coaching your patient? What are you telling them to watch out for? How are you managing this toxicity?
I mean, I'm really, really stressing the things that are likely to happen, right? So definitely the nail tox and the skin tox, like on the fingernails, that is something that every patient needs to know. We're using lotions up front as a preventative. It does seem to help a little bit on the margin, but that seems to be the one that gets us into the most trouble most quickly because it really disrupts daily life if it gets bad. Some of the ocular toxicity, we discuss it, but you know, we routinely send them to get their eye exams. We have an eye exam place in our buildings, which helps, and we're used to doing that through our clinical trials. So kind of just expand that to clinical.
How often are you getting their eyes checked? I mean,
Not
I
as
think
often on the
if
trials. It depends if they're having side effects. As soon as they're having, if they're having any kind of blurry vision, they go right away. But otherwise, it's kind of a little bit more loosey-goosey, probably doing it only every 6 months, probably should be doing it more, but realistically, we're really relying on them to be reporters, right? And I always tell my patient, this is something I think I mentioned on another podcast, is you have a homework assignment when you're on this drug. You have to be honest with us at the first sign of something changing in the skin or in the eyes or in the mouth, right? Let us know so we can get on top of things earlier rather than later. So I do, that's how I counsel it. I really make them take some ownership in the side effects. What about you?
Yeah, I generally have them go for a baseline up front, and then I'll usually have them get an eye exam 6 weeks in just to make sure, because sometimes patients don't really realize that there's some subtle changes. And so I usually have them at 6 weeks, and then we'll do another one at 3 months, and then I'll wait. At that point, I just wait till patients tell me that there's something going on, or they notice some changes, or they notice blurred vision or something like that. I definitely
I think
have
that's the
them.
ideal way to do it. I just find in the real world it's hard to do it that quick, that often, right? Patients are busy, they're coming in and out of clinics, and they don't like those extra appointments. But I agree, that's what we should be doing. I just personally, it's hard to really get that done.
It is. You're absolutely right. It is very hard. Oftentimes we have to set them up for them, and that's not easy. But I think it harps to them that that's an important thing that they have to monitor for. How often are you bringing them back in to monitor for the phosphate levels, the
So yeah,
fingernails?
definitely in that first 2 weeks, right? That's an important time to check the FOS so that you might have to raise from 8 mg to 9 mg, right? Which is part of that, you know, package insert. If those of you listening aren't familiar with that, please go ahead and go to the website and look at that because I think that's a nuance to this drug that's probably missed a lot. So definitely at that point, if they come in at 2 weeks, we're looking at their toxicity. It's an MD or APP visit as well as a lab check, right? And then we're seeing them again 2 weeks after that, and then we start to space them out to once a month.
Yeah, and that's very similar to what I do as well. Just so that we watch them closely on that drug. Do you ever start them more of like a really low dose at 3 milligrams or so, and then type?
See,
No.
I'm always one of the, everyone always asks, would you ever start lower? To me, if I don't think they can tolerate that drug at a reasonable dose, I use a different drug. Right? So, but no, I have not. I imagine that maybe you have because you're asking me the question, but I personally have not done that.
I have one
Okay.
patient where I've done it starting at 3 milligrams, and then I've titrated it up. But this patient was much older. She was in her 80s, and so these are, am I going to give her significant chemotherapy, or can I use this and then see how it goes? And so we started this way. That was more of an informed decision or shared decision making, as you were talking about earlier.
When I have my 87-year-old that wants to do EV pembro, I do start lower, by the way. So I will say there's a few exceptions to my rule there, but I titrate up. But normally I like to start at the full dose and then just rapidly come down if needed.
Okay. And one final question that I have is, because of what you just said, when are you stopping your EV for first line use?
Dude, that's a great question. That's a whole podcast topic for that question. I like to see a CR. Of course, I'm stopping if they're having, you know, starting to develop bad grade 2 neuropathy, right? Which is often that's a real clinical situation that happens with some frequency. But if they're in a radiographic CR or a really, really deep PR and you wonder what's viable, and they're ctDNA negative for multiple checks, right? And I'm using ctDNA negative status in all these patients. Granted, we probably shouldn't be recommending that that's ready for prime time because it's not, but I'm using it. And if I have seen a nice radiographic CR or near CR and I'm seeing CTDA negativity on multiple spaces and they've been on EV for maybe 3 to 4 months, at that point, I'll start to think about when is the time to come off. I want to give them at least, probably I like 6-ish cycles at least of EV. If I can stretch them out to 9, 10, 11 cycles, I will, but the neuropathy starts to become a challenge and I'll feel more comfortable with those kind of negative studies, negative DNA, negative imaging to start to pull off the EV and then just continue the pembrolizumab as a maintenance. But we don't have good answers as to what the number should be.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's widely variable
Yeah.
in terms of how we dose it, as well as dose reductions and schedule, and when do you stop and when do you restart? If you start noticing that there's some progression after you stop, I agree with you. That could be a whole podcast, but it's just more intriguing. I think we've kind of dissected out all of second line and beyond in bladder cancer. Very confusing, I would say.
Yeah, confusing, complicated, but unfortunately not enough drugs, which is why we could get it done in one podcast. So we need more of these early phase assets to move into the late phase and then to get regulatory approval, which hopefully will be on the horizon as we move into 2026 and beyond.
Well, we hope you enjoyed our podcast on second line and beyond in bladder cancer. Please reach out to us with any questions, comments, suggestions. We'd love to hear how you're doing, you're treating your patients with second line bladder cancer and beyond. Anything else, Ben?
No, thanks for listening. And please email us at our email as well as connecting with us on social media.